Welcome to the Mega Blast Podcast. I'm your host, Jason McDonald. My goal is to get to the truth through conversation. The Mega Blast Podcast is produced by Arts and Opinion, an online journal housed at the Archives of Canada. Visit us at artsandopinion.com. I hope you enjoy today's guest.
Welcome, Vincent Gelozo. How you doing?
Hi, how you doing?
Good, man. Good. I'm here with Vincent Gelozo, the great economist, French-Canadian economist, now at George Mason University. Before we, you know, the objective of this podcast is to, I want to talk mainly about your work about French Canada, Quebec, and what you call its convergence with the rest of Canada and North America. And some of the history and then some of the current challenges, and you know, that's kind of what I want to focus on. But before we get going, do you want to tell people listening a little bit about yourself, your background, and anything you just want to point out? I don't know.
I can say that I'm an assistant professor of economics at George Mason University, but I was born and raised in Montreal. Well, not exactly Montreal, the South Shore. So basically in St. Lambert, the small English enclave on the south side of Montreal. So I grew up there, went to University of Montreal, did my undergraduate degrees there. Dad's an immigrant, mom's a French Canadian. Did my master's and PhD in the UK at the London School of Economics. And then I've been roaming around in academia for more than a decade now, weirdly enough.
Yeah, it's your CV is really impressive when I go through it. I mean, it's in the state of Montreal and...
that doesn't count.
Yeah.
That doesn't count. I went there because it was convenient. It's nothing against the institution. It's just... I applied there because I lived closer to it than the other ones.
Right.
The
London School of Economics, is that the top school in the world for economics? Is it fair to say that?
No. It's the top ones are the usual suspects, Harvard, Princeton, MIT, Stanford. LSE is very, very high in the rankings, but it's not in the top five. It's like a top 20, I think I would call it.
That's interesting because it seems to have a very, very good reputation. One of the things that I remember about it is that one of its alumni, or at least a person who studied there, is Mick Jagger.
Yes.
So you're in good company.
I was afraid you'd go and go to Jacques Parizeau and compare me with him. I was like, yeah, no, I'm not sure it's the comparison I enjoy most, but I will take Mick Jagger.
Yeah, we're going to come back to Parizeau later in the podcast when we talk about...
Nothing against him. It's just I don't want to be compared to anyone.
Yeah, oh, no. Who would be? Who would want to be? I mean, the guy's this pompous, you know.
Right? I just dislike politicians on average.
Right.
I think
right.
I have a discomfort with the exercise of seeking power. And so that makes me uncomfortable with being compared to politicians.
Yeah.
That being said, of all the politicians I've seen, Jacques Parizeau is probably one of the smartest that I've observed, and probably also one of the most principled ones. Agree or not, he was by far probably one of the most impressive out there, still under the caveat that seeking power is not something that proper people should do.
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with you about his intelligence. He was very smart. It's a bit like Pierre Trudeau. As you may disagree with him, but you can't disagree with his intellectual capacity, right? You know,
yes,
that's my view.
And other types of capacity, like being mean, rude,
conniving,
a few other
right.
that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's not dwell on politicians.
No. I don't want to. Power. Yeah. I want it only in as much as it connects to the people of Quebec and the economy of Quebec and Canada You know what I mean? Like
Yep.
that's not now, but just like in the podcast, the politics sort of intersect there because they have an effect, right? But I just before we get on to the whole topic about, you know, the convergence and all that stuff, I just wanted to tell our listeners a little bit about how we met because there's kind of a, well, first of all, there's sort of a 6 degrees of separation going on. Do you remember how we met? Do you remember that?
I want to say Generation Screwed in Montreal at one point hosting an event.
Actually, no. It was because I drive Uber on the side, and I
Oh,
was driving
yes.
Uber. Yeah,
Yes.
and I picked you up. You remember?
Yes, I remember. I remember this. This was you had the Uber pig.
The Uber
No.
what?
No, there was a guy who picked me up. He had an account. That was when Uber was still controversial
Yes,
back
it
in the
was
day.
about 2016, 2017, something like that.
And the guy had, so I remember from the, I remember the car ride, but I think I'm mixing two car rides together now. And actually, I'm merging two people into one. But that other driver had an account on Instagram. He called it Uber Pigs. And it was his way of defiantly saying that he had the right to carry people around who were willing to be carried around. And if you agreed with him that he had the right to do this and you had the right to hire him, you could take a picture of him with a little marionette of a pig. And he would put it on Instagram and you'd be a member of the Uber Pigs Club. And I joined that club very heartily.
That's amazing. And so that's a different driver. That's not me, but that's really cool.
Oh, time has flown by, so I'm starting at this point in my life where my brain starts mixing stories together.
Oh,
So
for sure.
maybe I'm aging too much.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I wanted to mention too that I can tell by the way you're talking about Montreal and Quebec that you're used to talking to people who are not familiar with Quebec. You know, explaining where St. Lambert is and stuff like that. Many of the people listening to this are going to be my students who are there. It's a language course, an advanced course, and it's in business. So they're going to be familiar. That's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was because my students are somewhat familiar with some of the things that you've studied. So I just wanted to say that you don't need to be so, what's the word? Explaining about some of that stuff. You know what I mean? Like,
Okay,
sense.
okay.
No, what happened was I picked you up downtown and you got in the car and this was back, as you said, Uber at this point was had only been in Quebec for about 2, maybe 3 years at most, maybe even less. I started in 2015 when it was less than a year. And at that time we had to kind of run around and hide, and people would sit in the front of the car to make it look like
Oh,
human,
yes, I
right?
remember this. Oh, you're bringing me back. Yes, I remember going in the front, but also asking each other details about each other that way because
In case
the,
a cop, go ahead.
yes, I remember that. And we would pretend that you were just my buddy. Yeah, I forgot. This was the extent that was probably the most subversive thing I've had the luxury to do in my life.
Well, it touches on a lot of what you and I both believe about economics and the human person, that it's such an infringement on a person's freedom to tell them that they can't drive somebody else somewhere and accept a small payment for it. Like, is that fair to say? I mean, I don't know.
So I would phrase it a bit differently. I and while in whilst in agreement, I would say that I understood why there was aggressiveness towards Uber in general. And that is the result of the fact that taxi drivers who were being competed against by Uber were forced to buy licenses at very dear fees or rent them at very dear fees. And they had been playing by a set of rules that the government had imposed, and bad rules, but still rules per se. And they felt that A, they were their living standards were falling because of this, because you were shifting demand out of the usual channels, but they were still playing by the rules. And I understood the opposition people had to this, but they I think a more proper, I think that the thing I would emphasize is that the issue was not the use of Uber. It was the fact that we had required taxi drivers to acquire a piece of paper giving them the right to use their property as they saw fit, to carry people around. And that was also well above and beyond what you would consider like normal safety concerns. You don't need quantitative limits on the number of cab drivers. If like you're concerned about, say, safety, you can just have every driver register that they're being drivers, but there's no quantitative limit. It's just like a business license fee. Like you just go and register, have a company, you have a number, and your car is associated with that. That should have been the extent of the regulations that should have existed in Quebec. And I think that's the greater transgression. The greater transgression was not the state trying to crack down on Uber. It was that the state initially created taxi regulations the way they existed and then decided to keep going and extending these violations of property rights.
Yeah, no, you're quite right. I would just maybe illustrate some of what you're saying so perhaps some of the people listening could understand. Most people don't understand what a taxi license is.
Oh yeah, I
They
forgot this is an
yeah, no, it's okay.
yeah
They
the
think that it's just some sort of thing that you get, and then what the government has done in Quebec and in pretty much everywhere else in North America that I'm aware of is that it's either the city or the province or the state creates a certain number. So one way to compare it might be if let's say the government of Quebec said on the island of Montreal, there can only be 100 dépanneurs, right? So yeah, and so then you'd have to get a license to run one of those, and then the value of that license would be relatively high because there's only 100 of them instead of thousands, right? Because then it would mean that you if there's only 100 deps on the island of Montreal. What could those depths do? They could raise prices, right? Because people would need to go to those ones and the guys who had those, right? So that's what the situation was like. It was like there were these 100 taxis, let's say. I mean, I know there are more, but just so people can understand. And so the value of getting the right to drive a taxi at that time, it varied around the island of Montreal. The highest was Laval. It was around $211,000 to buy a taxi license in Laval. Montreal East, for some reason, had the lowest. Like I think it was like 120,000, but it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy this thing. And if you couldn't buy it, as you said, you had to rent it from a guy who had bought it in 1975, right? And
73.
that person might be sitting at home watching daytime TV while he collected a rent from a Haitian immigrant who was driving
Yeah, so
taxi,
let's
right?
just like we can tell the story of how this regulation started. So in 1973, the provincial government, and there had been an attempt by the city of Montreal, for example, for a long time, whatever the number of people who had legal rights to drive a cab at in 1973, they kept that right, but no extra licenses would be issued. That meant that you can picture what the population of Montreal was back then. It
50
was
years ago. It's
50
50
years
years ago.
ago. So you have richer Montrealers over those 50 years. That means demand goes up because people are wealthier, but also there's more Montrealers, period. So what do you think happens to the price of a license? The price of a license went up, so it was costlier for people to acquire the right to operate. And by the way, that right had to be paid. Once paid, it was not the right for a car, right? It was different. There was another permit you had to get. You had to get a permit of taxi. It was a right of ownership. Notice, like, this is a very important distinction in words. It was a right of ownership of a taxi. So you had the right to own a taxi, not the right to be a taxi. You then had to do an extra step, which was to acquire another license, which was itself very costly. But this is what this was meant as a restriction on people's ability to use their vehicles to provide services, because one of the complaints that it existed from cab drivers is especially when there were big international events. So you can go and look at, for example, when the International Exposition, Expo 67, was in town. A lot of people illegally offered cab services in Montreal.
Interesting.
Because there was a great inflow of people coming in, and what you had is average people knowing full well that demand had a surge at that particular point in time for a well-advertised international event. So you had people offering cab services, but these were like ordinary Montrealers with their own particular vehicles, and they just ferried people around. They even organized small activities of this. And there were mentions of this in the La Presse or other newspapers. Established cab drivers didn't really like that. They lobbied the government, got the restrictions and the permits of ownership. But the result was that the permits of ownership only benefited, and that's really important, only benefited the first players. Once the laws were passed, if you had the license in 73, you got it for free. It was grandfathered in, and you would keep the license afterwards, and you could sell it to the next person. But because demand had gone up for taxi services, you could sell the right of ownership at a higher price, and then you'd basically be passing on a hot potato, because the guy who bought it at a much higher price, he has to not lose his capital. He has to hope that he's going to sell it for himself at a higher price afterwards. And then that guy has to make the same hope, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's a highly vicious circle. And what happened is that you had cab drivers with mortgages of $250,000 just for the right to operate was essentially a very low fixed entry cost activity, because they had to acquire a legal right to, I should even say right, a legal privilege. That's
yeah, it's better to use the word privilege. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a connotation in the word rights. They had to acquire a legal privilege to operate that service. And their only hope to pay that mortgage was to be able to sell the permit in the future at somebody else at a higher price than what they had purchased it for.
Yeah. So this system, it technically still exists, you know, just to close the loop on this. There are still taxi licenses. One of the things that I think a lot of people didn't quite understand too is that taxis and Ubers are not exactly the same. They're very similar, but they're not identical, you know. Taxis are more anonymous. You can pay cash in a cab. You can't pay cash in an Uber. Taxis can do certain things Ubers can't do. You know, the lanes on the 20 going to the airport, there's these taxi lanes. You can fly by the traffic. I can't drive in those, right? I have to hump it with all the traffic or whatever. So if I have a person in my Uber, they have to sit in the traffic, right? So anyway, these are small distinctions. But what happened was, after all the warring went on between the government and the, you know, it really was crazy. I had Jean-Nicolas, I'm blanking on his name. He was the head of Uber Quebec. I had him in my car twice. And so I had him explaining a lot of the stuff of what they were trying to do with the government and everything. Finally, they came to a deal. And Uber is now regulated the same as taxis, in the sense that we have to go and get, it's a class 5 license, I believe, or a 4, anyway, you know, the same as a taxi has to get, you know, it's like it's a test, you know, to make sure that you are a good driver. They do background checks, which Uber had been doing all along anyway. I mean, Uber had always done police checks of its drivers. And the requirements to check the vehicles have been increased up to the level of the taxi, because Uber had a very simple mechanical verification. But it's basically been regulated, and there was a buyback. Are you aware of this? That there was a buyback? Yep. I believe it was $40,000 for those who wished to sell their permits. Uber collected the money together as part of a deal to pay taxi owners, taxi license owners. I believe it was $40,000.
Without extending ourselves too much on this.
I know.
We could spend a lot of time on this topic.
I want to finish it up, but I just thought I'd close with that. It's basically been solved. But
I would point out that the issue was never whether or not the regulations that existed should be repealed, and that the market should have been liberalized. The regulations were doing tremendous harm. The new technologies were far superior. The only question that had been on the table was how to exit without hurting too many people, the current or then current bad system of regulation.
Right.
The only issue was the how, not the if. And that was, I won't lie, I had back and forth in my mind on this, because some people did legally acquire a right that was supposed to be transferable. So the government created a transferable privilege that was a form of property. But once created, abolishing them meant dispossessing people of an asset, which amounts to a takings by government. Yeah. And which is unacceptable. And it's the how do you exit a system like that is always more painful than anything else, but it doesn't mean you shouldn't end it. The issue is the how, never the if.
Do you think it was fair? I think it was $40,000 or $45,000.
I forget the details.
But do you think that was that seemed reasonable to me? That's, you know, for, I don't know.
It's been long. It's been 5 years now. My son was born the same day that the day after I testify in a parliamentary.
Oh, is that right?
the day after. Like, I went back to Montreal after he was born. I went to Quebec City. My first son was born the day right after I testified. Or
wow.
A few days after. I'm not sure anymore, but it was like not long after. So I won't lie, the last 5 years have been a flurry with the kids that I didn't keep up with that particular aspect of policy.
That's amazing. You were testifying there. Okay. So let's move on a little bit. One final thing I'll say, just one sort of a bit of a joke, was that you got in the car and we started driving. And for some reason, you started talking in English to me. And I know you're a Francophone. And that was, most of the time, Francophones don't do that.
It's because of St. Lambert. St. Lambert is half French.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Right.
My parents are half French, half English. And my mom is from Acadia. Well, actually, you could say my mom is half French, half English because she's Acadian.
Okay, right. She's what's that called? Chiac? Is that language they speak there in New Brunswick? Yep. Right. Yeah. Yep.
My mom's from Shediac.
Okay. Nice. Wow. Okay. Cool. So we were driving and we started talking, and you mentioned you were an economist and so, you know, and all this, and I started explaining some of my views about, you know, like I'm a classical liberal or a libertarian or whatever, and I remember you looked at me and you were like, this is amazing. Like,
I remember. Do you remember that? I remember this now more and more clearly as we're talking.
Yeah.
And you told me about, now for your auditors, this is not going to be, your listeners, it's not going to be particularly interesting, but I'll just say it really. You mentioned Mike Guetta to me.
Yeah, I possibly did. Yeah.
Because Mike had been and still is a great friend. And when you said that, I was like, okay, yes, this guy really is on the same side of the fence I am. It's
yeah. Mike Guetta is quite a character.
Singer. Not the singer.
Right. Not David Guetta.
Yeah. Sorry. Yes. You see how little I know about.
Yeah. Myself. David Guetta is the French DJ. Okay. Mike has a tagline that we could close the loop on this with, is that his thing that he says is that government must be destroyed. Right. The government causes all these kinds of problems. Right, like intervening in people's right to exchange.
Mike is very radical.
Yeah, and, he is. And
also for a radical, and this is a lesson for if you have some listeners who are a bit more radical in their reflex, it's possible to be a radical without being a complete, you know what, to people.
That's right.
Mike is insanely cordial, insanely polite. Even to people who disagree with him, this ability to civilly disagree is probably Mike's greatest skill.
Yeah, he really is a testimony to a person can be an extremist and openly admitted and also function well in the world with other people. Yep. You know, it's really an incredible testimony to, I think, and he's a very good person. Yeah. Okay, so let's move on. Yeah, I read a good part of, because you gave me a bunch of your books at one point when you were leaving.
Yep.
Thank you again for that. Some amazing books. I mean, I was reading these books. It was like, wow, this is incredible, you know. But one of them was your book published in 2013 in French, Le Grand Rattrapage, okay, which is a very, very interesting book about Quebec in the 20th century, and some of the economic growth that took place there. But what I wanted to do is my students will be sort of familiar with that story through their history classes, right? They've grown up, they've gone to school. So before you get to, I'd like you to explain your main thesis there. Could you steel man the conventional view about the Catholic Church and the way that the Quebec society functioned from about 1900 up to, say, 1960 or 1965? Like, just imagine you're one of these people at Radio-Canada, who are like really smart and everything, and they know things, and they're going to explain why everything was horrible for French Canadians during that period. Is that hard? I apologize if it's
So there
difficult.
are mul the reason I'm struggling a bit is that there's multiple steel mans that I could make on their side, and each of them they would agree with to some degrees of variance represents their particular views. But I will try to draw the one that is a common denominator across all sides. It is that pre-1960, and we can disagree about how strong of a break point 1960 is. Quebec is a highly conservative society with strong anti-statist reflexes, strong clerical influence.
Religious
Really,
church,
yeah, by clerical, I don't mean clerical work. I mean religious, like clerical. Sorry, I think I made a Franglish translation. So highly religious organization of social activities, limited intervention by the state into pretty much every sectors and backwards. Okay, and what I mean by backwards, this is where the steel manning has to be. There's multiple versions. Some will say that Quebec had a generally, and this is where I will be a bit cruel, is what they perceive as modern is whether or not you have a strong developed state. So if you were backwards, that's because you had a very small state doing very, very few stuff. But the one thing they will agree, and that I actually also agree with, is that up to a certain point, and maybe on the dating we can disagree, is that Quebec was also an exceptionally poor society within North America. So, and it's important here to say within North America, because my expertise is as an economist is to do economic history. So I study, I recreate data from the distant past. And it has to be understood that Quebec has always been a rich society by global standards, going as far back as the colonial period. So it is a rich place globally. But North America is historically the richest place in the world, period. Even today, like people forget this, but Black Americans who are the poorest of the lot in North America are in the top 10% of the world globally. Like there are exceptionally rich people. The United States, the rest of Canada, Quebec are exceptionally wealthy society by global standards. There's no way around it. But within North America, French Canadians were the poor group. So you can think of the French Canadian, when people were thinking of backwards, what we're describing is the poor of the rich. Okay. So it's never been that kind of a poor society, the way we think of poor as we would think of, say, Russia in 1900 or
Sub-Saharan
Turkey.
Africa for an
Yes.
extreme example,
Yeah.
right? Oh, right.
So Quebec was
Yeah.
always a very rich society. But within the group of the rich people, especially since it makes the contrast particularly stark, it made it look like, wow, what a bunch of backwards, what a backward society. And that's the picture people draw. That is the
Yeah.
best simple steel man I can do of their arguments. And then
Yeah.
the other steel man is that the 1960 and afterwards is the rise of a more interventionist state with a strong Francophone majority that is able to direct economic development and promote education in a way that creates a very rapid process of convergence. That's the best
The
steel man
steel
I can
man.
do.
Yeah, a couple of things I just mentioned quickly before you go on to your thesis is very interesting. People don't understand that North America is really richer. I mean, there's a few points. One I heard is that if you took the 50 million Afro-Americans, Black Americans, and you separated them out as a nation, right, that would be the richest group of people of African descent in the world.
Yes.
Right,
So this
people don't
is.
understand this. They think, oh, blacks, and but by American standards, blacks are poorer on average
Yes.
than the other Americans,
And
right?
that's the reason that some people, and we're opening a small parenthesis here, why some people would call this the tragedy of the United States is that the United States has is exceptional in a very great number of ways in terms of its institutions. So and the part that's kind of fascinating is, and this is the economist Walter Williams, who was here at
Brilliant
Mason,
economist. Yeah,
brilliant
passed
economist,
away.
a great pedagogue. More importantly, students still revere him decades after they have had him in their class. And Walter Williams was an African American economist from Philly, with a very strong personality. He was 6'3", and
Oh, wow. I didn't know that
Williams said
about
that
him.
the worst thing that ever happened to his ancestors, to his great grandparents, was to come to America. The great thing that happened to his grandparents was to be born in America. And in that, he conveyed this great tragedy of the United States, which is it is a land whose institutions are so insanely good at promoting economic development, at promoting individual betterment. And that at the same time, it was denied to some. And that's the tragedy because you can imagine counterfactuals in your head where you would have the richest group of that the US would be a much richer place than it would be the case, a much less fractious place than would be the place had the ideals of American institutions been extended to everyone equally. That's the
Well, they
great tragedy of
were,
the United States.
they have been.
They have
They
been,
have
but I
been,
mean,
yeah.
to have been
Right.
consistently and historically applied,
Historically, yeah.
yes, to have historically been applied consistently to all.
Well, you could, I mean, if just to close the loop on Afro-Americans, there's a couple of points. One is that
No,
I,
but it's not, these are related, right? So remember Pierre Valliere, the very horrible human being. I mean,
Les
no, this
nègres
is.
blancs de la mer Amérique du Nord, I think
Yeah,
was the quote.
I don't want to say the name for
Excuse
because
me. Yeah, I
no.
apologize.
It's I think the word is I live in the US and I understand why the word is not a word to use. It
Yeah,
is
I
meant.
apologize if
No,
anyone, I didn't mean any
no.
offense
It's
to
I
anyone.
it's
Just,
it is for people who maybe not are listening and are not Canadians. In French, the N word doesn't carry any aggressive derogative meaning. It is meant as a purely descriptive word that has fallen into disuse today. It is not meant as a slur. It has never been used as a slur, but the word is has been now understood as a slur. So people who don't understand where this 8 million people in North America speak differently, it's easier just to not say it in this case. But
Fair enough.
Valliere, who is, let's remember, a very violent man. And I say this as a guy who has some sympathy for the separatist movement in Quebec. Separatists like to compare themselves a lot to Black Americans. So his title, The White Ends of America, is the idea that French Canadians were as poor as Black Americans and were as poorly educated as Black Americans. And to a high degree, this is true. So if you compare the living standards of not perfectly true, but there was greater similarity than dissimilarities between the two groups. Relative to the richer group, they start further back. So, for example, if you take the wage gap, so this is actually part of the steel man of the or the more conventional thesis. If you take, say, the income of French Canadians in Quebec as a share of English Canadians in Quebec, you get that the incomes are roughly 50 to 60% of the English.
So that means if an Anglo makes $100,000 a year, A Francophone would make $50,000 or $60,000 a year, pretty much at
Exactly.
the same level of, I don't know if the same level, I don't know if it's the same level, but
Yeah,
on average, right?
that would be on average. Not
Yeah.
all else being equal, but on average. So we're not
Right.
controlling
Not
for
doing the
race.
same thing. They're not
Not
doing
doing
the same
they're not
job. It's
doing the
very
same
important to
thing.
point that out. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's the same, it's roughly the same gap as white Americans and black Americans and stuff.
Right. So
So
50, 40, 50%. Yeah.
there is a huge gap. You check the number of years of schooling completed. It is roughly the same. Percentage of less than 9 years of schooling, roughly the same. Literacy rate, say in 1920, illiteracy rate, sorry, roughly the same. So Black Americans and French Canadians were two very poor group within this really rich place that was North America. And this is why some separatists like Valliere, as despicable as Valliere is as a person, were carrying a correct point that there was something there was something that spoke to some form of perceived injustice in people's head. For I can't think of another word than injustice, but that because they were so much poor, there was some form of injustice being carried, and the
I think the
comparisons.
implication that people like Valliere, intimate, is that there's some sort of a design that somehow, like in the American case, that whites are sort of conspiring to keep blacks poor, and that in Canada, Anglos and maybe Jews, there's a lot of anti-Semitism too, that, that somehow it's sort of a design, like the economy was and culture was set up in such a way that Francophones are going to end up at the bottom and they're going to be poor. Is that a fair statement, you think, that point of view, that
So
worldview?
there is a group of people who believe that there is some form of a design for this, but others will point out that this is so within the group of people who advertise for this, they won't blame the Anglophones.
Right.
They will
Okay.
blame the Francophones themselves for their political choices. So
Right,
that there is that the stigma is not carried to the Anglophone. And let's be very clear. If the living standards of Black Americans and French Canadians do compare, there's a lot of things that don't compare. French Canadians, there's no lynch mobs going
that's
after French
right. Yeah,
Canadians.
it's a very good
There
point.
is no
Yeah.
legal discrimination against French Canadian. There are no black codes against them. There are no restrictions on their legal ability to leave a particular place and work elsewhere. So let's make this very clear, and this probably tells you why, at least in one of the earlier Steelmans I drew up for that you requested,
Yeah.
that the most aggressive separatists who argue that there was some form of designs, I don't think that holds just because you can look at African Americans and you realize that they are doing as well or as poorly, if you want. They're doing as poorly as French Canadians. In spite of aggressive and systemic legal discrimination against them. Like we're talking, this is Jim Crow era. This is the
Yeah,
era where
that's right.
there are,
Pre-1960 Southern United
yeah, this
States
is
would be, yeah.
pre-civil rights
Yeah.
era. This is before Martin Luther King. This
Right,
is when
just to be clear.
there is set the
There's
debt with the,
legal discrimination against
yeah, the
blacks
state.
in a large portion of the United States, yeah.
So this doesn't exist in Quebec. And
Yeah.
the fact that it
Yeah.
doesn't exist and it, and that the differences are roughly the same tells me that something else.
That's the factor is not a deliberate legal
Yeah.
system that's discriminating against the group, because those are two groups that, in theory, if that were the difference, then French Canadians should have been at a much higher level because
Yes.
there was no legal discrimination. Something else is going on
There
there.
is another
Yeah.
process that's going
Right.
on. That's
Or
why
other things. Yeah.
the other groups of that I criticize would argue that it's education.
Yeah.
That the way the education system was set up in Quebec actually discouraged the accumulation of human capital and had the adverse effect of setting French Canadians on a different course. And it had nothing, it was not a deliberate intent to hurt them. And the fact is, as soon as educational reforms were enacted, French Canadians converged very rapidly.
Okay. I want to come back to the convergence in a minute, but just to stick to this period. So just to close it, a big part of it is, I think, one of the things I hear a lot from French Canadians in particular is this story that, the Catholic Church basically was this sort of thing that was very, dominant, and there was this imposition, especially on women, to have lots of children. And if you look at it from an economic perspective, a group of people that has many children, by definition, is going to be poorer than a group of people that has a smaller number of
No,
children.
I disagree with
No,
that.
is that not true? Yeah.
No, that I have a strong disagreement
Really?
with that
Okay.
claim.
Just can I just outline why I think that?
Yeah,
Because
go ahead.
yeah,
I
it's
just want to
because
state a
like
very strong
if I
dissent.
make $50,000 a year, and I have and I and I'm you know and I have a wife and one child, then we have $50,000 split three ways. If I make $50,000 a year and I have two children, it goes four and five and six and seven. So doesn't it fall? Like I look at groups that are considered poorer, like Hispanics, they have high rates of numbers of children and young people.
Yeah,
Right? Is that
but
not
it's
a reasonable assumption? And the French Canadians had very, very high rates
yeah,
of
but you're getting correlation and causation and
Okay, pardon me. Yeah,
no, no, no,
please
it's
explain.
okay.
Yeah.
So first of all, let's remember the larger the size, there are economies of scale in households. So if I get an extra, if there's an extra person that joins my household, we're not going to increase spending by a
Right.
full
The
by the
rent
value of.
stays the same, the heating stays the same, that
There's
kind
even
of thing. Right.
economies of scales in cooking. For example, like I don't need to cook as much. I can cook like a much larger meal, and it lasts like I can do like larger portions. I can buy in bulk. There's economies of scales in large
That's
numbers.
interesting. Yeah, I
So this
hadn't
is
thought of
why,
that.
like, so first of all, the cost of an extra person to a household is not as high
It's
as
not a simple percentage addition. It actually the percentage diminishes
yes.
because you're saving money on all these other
Yes.
things.
So
Yeah,
this
right. I
means that,
understand. Yeah.
so that's the first thing. The second thing is, kids are a form of wealth. So later on, first of all, they work. Eventually, they can provide a form of retirement savings for you. They can help you out. So that's like a first thing. So that there is like an upside to this. Also, family and kin create networks. And networks have, so I know you've had Mike Munger on, and I sure he said transaction costs a million
I
times
think
because the answer, I never know
the
what.
entire podcast was the answer is transaction costs, right?
Yes, so yeah, that's actually, he's actually correct on this.
Is
I don't know
correct,
what
yeah.
the answer is, but transaction cost is the answer. And if you have a tightly knit kin network,
Transaction costs go down,
yes,
right?
so there's
Yeah, right.
upsides to family
Yeah.
size.
That's extremely interesting, Vincent. I appreciate you explaining that because that's something I had never thought of before in that calculation of more children. Yeah, it's really, really cool.
So
Yeah.
there is that. So I would push back against the religious explanation. I
Okay.
think so
Okay.
in presenting my
Yeah,
counter
I just
reply.
wanted, yeah, you could, yeah, please explain your counter to that whole thesis. Yeah.
So the counter is that there's a series of dissonant notes in the data. So the book has stuff that I didn't say then that I've been able to document since and work more on. So the book was a first step onto something, and by the way, the 10th anniversary of it edition is now online. So this is there's the if you go on Amazon and look for the Grand Rattrapage ou Déclin Tranquille, and you want
It's an
to.
excellent book, Vincent. Like I
Well, not only
really
that,
do.
I'm very
Yeah.
happy to say that I bought back the rights from my editor,
Okay.
and so that I could edit it myself in the future, put it on self-publish on Amazon, and later
Cool.
on, as time would
Wow.
go by, I could make it cheaper and more accessible, but also be able to take parts of it for a forthcoming book that I'm writing for.
Okay.
So it's
Wow.
a work in progress. There's some stuff in it that's not there. But the part that's in the book, I'll tell you this part first. Number one, the dates, the convergence process doesn't start in 1960. From 1870 to 1920, Quebec's living standards increased, but much more slowly than the rest of Canada. So Quebec, actually, people don't notice, but Quebec starts at Confederation with incomes that are between 85 and 90% of those in the rest of Canada.
Wow.
I'm sorry. Not the rest of Canada. Ontario.
Ontario. That's amazing. That is amazing to know.
And we were richer than the Maritime Provinces.
Wow.
From then to 1920, Quebec grows, but it grows much more slowly than the rest of Canada. So by 1920, we're as poor as the Maritimes. So we converge to them in terms of relative standing. And we are at somewhere between 55 and 65% of the income of Ontarians. So there is a process. Now, it's important. This is a relative process. It's not that our absolute living, that our income fails. It's just that our incomes increase more slowly than those of Ontarians for the period from 1870 to 1920. Then there is a stagnation. We stay in that 55 to 65 range until 1945. But from 1945 onwards, we're converging. And in fact, if you...
Very quickly. That's only 15 years up to 1960, right?
Yeah, and from 1945 to 1975, it's the same pace of convergence. Wow. If you plot everything, there is no break. There is no difference in the pre-60 and the post-60. We're converging at the same pace. The real and more important date seems to be happening sometimes in the 40, which is when we're starting to converge. And you're not just seeing it in the average of the population. So I have some articles that have since been published, where what you see is actually that the living standards of, for example, Francophones start converging with Anglophones from 1940, from the census of 1941 onwards. With Jason Dean of King's University College in Ontario, and Jason's a really good economist, we tested out, okay, what happens if we hold constant for education, for years of experience, for bilingualism, because it's important to understand that for Francophones, one way to earn extra was not to go to school an extra year, was to speak English.
Yeah.
Learning English actually had the same effect as 2 years of education.
Wow.
In our calculations. So Francophones, and you could see that there was, until 1941, for example, a rising rate of bilingualism amongst Francophones. Francophones would learn English as a substitute to going to school.
To access employment opportunities, exactly. Even within Quebec, they could raise their economic status by having English as a...
Yeah, or just like making business with English people.
Right,
you have a greater pool. So you see that. In 1941, things invert. Francophones stop becoming bilingual at the same rate. Huh. You start seeing Anglophones becoming bilingual.
In 1941, did you say?
From the trend starts in 1941.
Wow, that's so from way the 1941 before the official bilingualism of the 60s and 70s. Yes. The way the story is told, right?
So the way we tell it in my work is, what mattered was education, and the big reform that people don't know happened was that in 1943, Quebec was the last province to adopt compulsory schooling laws, and this seems like it's a strange point to make, but it's the only one that explains why the convergence would have picked up at this time. All the other provinces had adopted compulsory schooling laws many decades before, like multiple decades before. Quebec is the last place that adopts compulsory schooling and also makes it cost like a zero priced compulsory schooling. So parents don't have to pay to go to school. And it's not necessarily the compulsory schooling that's making the effect. Is that before, what you had was that the church had a monopoly on schooling. And the point of schooling in that case was to use education as a vehicle to resist cultural assimilation, not accumulate human capital.
Can we translate that for people, just so people understand what you mean?
The fear was that if education, so that was the bargain at Confederation. Why did the provinces end up with powers over education? The federal has none of it. And why there's no like Department of Education at the federal level in Canada is because the bargain was, we will support, Francophones will support Confederation if you guys give up education at the federal level so that you guys don't try to assimilate us.
Using the education system as an assimilation mechanism into the English language. Yeah, like exactly. Not to that, do
that.
Yeah.
That is the true bargain of Confederation.
Yeah.
It
yeah.
is that we are going to, you're going, so what the trade was, and I call it the Confederacy of Beggars, this is a work in progress that I have, is Francophones who used to be free traders traded their support for free trade, so they supported the protectionist conservatives in exchange for education remaining in the hands of the Catholic Church and not in the hands of the federal government, so that basically we could resist cultural assimilation by Anglophone. That was the bargain of Confederation.
Okay.
The down effect of that is you gave a monopoly to
the church.
To the church.
Yeah.
On education, and the point was not to acquire skills. In the 40s, when you get the adoption of compulsory schooling laws, the state still is a monopolist, but the difference is that now it's a monopolist whose main goal is to promote human capital. So, I mean, I would have preferred if you had just broken the monopoly and allowed everyone to engage in entrepreneurship and education and have like something like vouchers. But in terms of a swap, it was a better swap. You were trading a bad monopoly for a less bad monopoly.
Right.
And that happens sometimes in history. But from there, you can observe like a series of things. Younger Francophones have massively higher rates of high school and university completion. They start joining the workforce. In fact, when you break, so I have an article with Julien Gagnon, Marie-Pierre Isabelle, where we break the people from the different censuses by age cohort. So when were they born? And we realize that there is no convergence of Francophones and Anglophone within age cohorts. So what happens is that the old Francophones stay at 45 to 50, 55 to 65% of the old Anglophones, but the younger ones are catching up. So what you find is that over time, so a person born in say 1910 or 1920, by the time it's the 1940 census, he earns 50% of the Anglophone. By the 1951 census, that guy born in 1910 or 1920 also earns the same proportion. So there's no change. But for the younger ones, what you realize is that there's like a staircase convergence.
So the children start doing better.
They start doing better. Yeah. And you observe the people who are born fully into the cohort that's affected by the 43 reform of compulsory schooling. So those who were of the age of maybe dropping out, okay, in that group, you realize that by 1960, so by the time we observed them in the 1971 census, the kids are fully equal to the English.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1971, within the young Francophone group, there is no socioeconomic differences between wow. French and English.
That's
so the convergence is completed in the 1943 to 71 period. And it's just that older people have a harder time. I mean, at 50 years of age, you're not going to go back to school. There's a kind of a sunk cost that's there, and it sucks. But for the young kids, for the younger ones, the reform has a huge effect. And so the convergence of, if you look at the convergence of income of Francophones to Anglophones, in Quebec, it's largely explained by basically that in 1941, what you have is mostly a lot of people born before the reform. And as you move in time, you have more and more people born after the reform. And it causes what looks like a convergence that's continuous over time. But what you really had in practice was a big change at a particular BERT cohort. People affected by the educational reforms. So the real start date of Quebec's convergence is 43 to it starts in 1943. And that really changes everything else from there, because the convergence starts in a period where the state does very little. Quebec still has a very small government relative to the rest of Canada. It has insanely lower taxes than the rest of Canada. It has higher rates of entrepreneurship.
That would amaze most modern listeners who know anything about Canada, I think.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, but Yes, and I think it still amazes like a lot of people when I tell them that
Just to
Quebec.
be clear to our younger listeners, Quebec is known in Canada for a very large welfare state, and it has, as I understand it, entrepreneurship rates are probably better in, especially in Western Canada and Ontario and so on, than they are in Quebec and all that.
Taxes are higher as well,
Taxes are much
regular.
higher in Quebec. Yeah, exactly.
So
And this
the
was the opposite in the 1940s and 50s, what you're
Yep,
saying.
Quebec had
Right.
a
Okay.
very
And
small
Quebec was
government.
more entrepreneurial. It had less state intervention. It was more vital in many respects.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
But the reason why this changes is that in the earlier Steelman I gave you, the date is 1960 that starts the convergence with the rise of a more interventionist state that starts participating more actively in the economy. In the story I just told you, the convergence started well before then, and it didn't need a state. It didn't need a strong estate. So it's removing causal weight to the quiet revolution that starts in 1960. In fact, the way I put it in my work is the quiet revolution is a product of the convergence that
Right,
happens.
it's reversed.
Is it's reverse. It's not a
Reversed,
causal
yeah.
effect. It is a caused effect. It is the result of a previous series of events, and that's the it's not it doesn't cause anything. In fact, I have a paper I'm revising with one of my graduate students, and we use a I don't want to bore your listeners with a particular crazy econometric method, but we're able to simulate what Quebec would have looked like. So we asked the question, does the quiet did the quiet revolution matter? And we check on indicators like income per capita, income per household, wages per worker, life expectancy, years of schooling. So we're taking all of these variables and we're putting them in all together. And we say, okay, we're going to use the other provinces to create a best predictor from 1943 to 1960. We're going to try to see the one that really matches the data. And afterwards, we're going to use that prediction to say Quebec is the only one that gets the quiet revolution. Okay, that supposedly is Quebec different than this weird counterfactual we created? So we're going to compare the real data with the one that's based on the past data. And what we find is that there's no difference. There is no difference.
Interesting.
Quebec doesn't pick up faster because of after 1960 in terms of income. It doesn't pick up faster in terms of life expectancy. It doesn't pick up faster in terms of school enrollments. We find nothing. It has the
Yeah.
only thing that we find a really strong causal effect that something really did change in 1960, something like meaningfully was altered, was the size of government. It's the only thing that changes. And
I just want to say something quickly about what you're saying. Sorry to interrupt. I just want to make it clear to listeners because I think many people believe that societies are wealthy because the government puts in laws like minimum wage and work protections, and so like we live in a really developed society in Quebec or in wherever in Western Europe or whatever. But what you're saying is that it's exactly the opposite, that in order to have all the social programs and all that stuff, you need to have an economic development in the first place,
yes,
right?
I would actually say this. I so this is work that other people have done, but that the welfare state, okay, let me do like a quick distinction here. I make a very strong distinction between intervention in the economy, so that's regulation, like state-created monopolies, tariffs. I distinguish those from redistribution.
Right,
I think
because they are
intervention, and
different.
there's a strong case to be made that these make things worse. On like 90%, 90 plus percent of cases, that it's hard to sustain that they're good. Redistribution has a harder case against it to make because there's ways in which redistribution can stimulate economic growth in some ways by promoting opportunities for people who are born in poor places. So if like for example, if the transfer is about allowing a person who is cash constrained to finance education, then it's actually a good thing. It's going to promote development in this way. So the empirical case against the welfare state is not as strong as some libertarians would want
Fair
to have it.
enough.
However, the thing that's very clear is that the origins of the welfare state are always in the sense that there's been economic growth. Well, first dates are a luxury of rich societies.
Right.
Like, very much so. You don't see welfare state emerge until you have very rich societies. So the welfare state maybe causes some extra growth, according to some. And I'm willing to have the empirical conversation on this. But let's be very clear. That one is very clearly true empirically. Welfare states exist when you are rich.
That's right. Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make. Yeah, is that,
I just wanted to make and carry that nuance.
Okay, that's really, really interesting. So that brings us up to the modern era. We're coming up on time, so I want to just cover a couple of things quickly. I want to talk about something uncontroversial, which is the Parti Québécois and the nationalist movement, quickly, bringing us into the modern era, because I know that I follow your work on this, your work on the effect of separatism. I want to just outline the conventional view. So just quickly, in 1976, the Parti Québécois is elected, and so that's a party that openly promoted, you know, the separation of Quebec into a new country. And that movement continued right. It continues to some extent into this century, although it's less popular now than it was. It marked me as a young person. I think I'm a bit older than you. I was born in 1972.
Yeah, so, you are.
Yeah. So I'm right. Okay. You're not going to mention your age.
No.
But I just want to say, I remember in vivid detail the riots in 1995 on the streets of Montreal. I was actually there, I wasn't rioting myself, but I witnessed people, you know, Le Québec, au Québec, what, burning cars and this kind of, like, it was a serious, serious thing that was very, very powerful movement. And the standard wisdom is that this movement came along, and because there was this hesitancy where, you know, sort of like, we don't know if we're going to elect a government that might separate all the time, from 1976 up to perhaps, you know, 2010 or something like that, there was this idea that somehow that suppressed economic growth, and that economic growth was, you know, that investment and all this stuff, because people were concerned about, you know, far leftist elements in the separatist movement and all this stuff. That's the standard view. That's the standard view. Your evidence that I've seen you promoting, like what you put out on social media, and I read some of your papers when I can, seems to indicate that there was no effect because of the separatist movement, that it had.
No, there were none. And
yeah, okay, I wonder if you could explain that, because it seems counterintuitive. But
I'd be very happy to, because weirdly enough, so I did tell you that I'll give a caveat to your listeners. I have some separatist sympathies, and they were there before I wrote the paper I'm about to talk about, but they have been strong. They have been strengthened by my own results. I didn't expect.
Yeah.
I didn't expect what I found. Okay, so let's be very clear. I was initially puzzled, but the more I think about it, the more I think what I say makes sense. So that's why I'm going to start with why we can expect that there's no effect. So when we look at separatism generally around the world, separatist movements are economically costly. But it's not because they're separatists. It's because most of the time they're violent. That's either because it's the mean they think they have to push for reform, to push for political exit, or it's the one that they're obliged to go into by virtue of the existing government. So, for example, why is it that in Catalonia, you had, or in the Basque country, you had terrorist wings for all intents and purposes? It's because the Spanish government says that Spain is a one and an indivisible country. And it makes that any political option that includes like democratic option are not going to be on the table, right? So you're going to have that a separatist movement is going to be violent. In the case of the Kurds in Turkey, of course it's going to be violent because, well, Turkey is not a democracy. It's like, it's a very much like an autocracy where you have a very strong authoritarian ruler. And trust me, if the Kurds want to leave, the government will send in the army. So the separatist movement is violent. In these settings, separatism is costly. But in liberal democracies, Scotland, Canada, that's not an option. Tomorrow morning, if Quebecers vote to leave Canada, federal government's not going to send in the army. They're not. They're just not going to. Under democratic setting, you have to convince voters to do this. You have to, like, by virtue of like being under a democratic setting, you have to convince the voters. So that means that you have to do one of two things. If you're a member of the separatist coalition, you have to minimize by any means possible the cost and the perceived cost of exit. So that means that you get the story of what happened to the PQ from 1968 to 1976 is the entire exercise that René Lévesque conducted was to marginalize the radicals. He kicked out Pierre Bourgault, who made speeches in favor of Mao and saying that we needed a cultural revolution in Quebec. Filthy, disgusting human being, which I still don't understand as being.
I saw him speak once at UQAM.
He made speeches in the
very 70s. Powerful speaker.
Indeed. But he did say that we needed to have a cultural revolution like Mao had in China. And it was
a hard leftist.
A very hard leftist. You also had the members of the FLQ who were terrorists. Let's not lie.
Some were exiled from Canada, you could say.
The Rose brothers. So what you had
went to Cuba. Some of them went to Cuba and they were the kids were raised in Cuba and then they came back and all this stuff.
Which should tell you something. Which should tell you something. But René Lévesque spends most of the 70s trying to marginalize these radicals. In the process, what he's trying to do is say, look, separation is not going to be costly. To prove it to you, I'm going to kick out people who are helping me do it. I'm going to kick them out of the movement. I'm going to marginalize them so much that they're not going to do any. They're not going to participate in the conversation. And all the hardcore separatists hated René Lévesque for doing this. They hated him.
That's right. Yeah, it's
the
true.
Only situation then. So the separatists have to commit themselves to win. In order to win, they have to commit themselves to being.
Peaceful.
To offer a not only peaceful, but a low-cost way of exit.
Yeah, right.
They cannot win election if they don't credibly do this. Or, alternatively, if the other side, the non-separatist camps, or the Federalists here, don't do something that make it costlier to stay within the polity. So if the other one does something, makes a really bad mistake, then you're increasing the odds of separation, holding constant the perception of the cost of separation, right? But the other side control essentially what you want to think is the Federalists control the benefits to some degree of staying or leaving if they promise. And this is why you have every time there will be talk of a referendum, the federal government will always commit to act berserkly. They will promise to act in the most aggressive fashion possible. That we will take out the jets. You will not be included in the union. Your money, don't expect anything from us. Everything will have to be negotiated. Doing this increases the perception of cost of leaving.
Right.
And the separatists have no control over that behavior. It is the rational behavior of the federal government in that case. So the only thing that separatists can control is what they do and what they do to affect costs. You can't win elections if you don't credibly commit to reduce cost of separation more than the other one promises to increase them. By definition, that means that there should be no effect of if a PQ government wins an election, there should be no effect because it means that theoretically they've convinced and people expect lower cost, that they don't expect that this will be a costly move.
Right, right.
And when we run with the data, we find exactly that.
So that's confirmed.
Yeah, that is confirmed. There is every election, Quebec behaves, its GDP per capita evolves at the same pace as what the theory would expect in the long run. So there is no net loss. There is no net gains, by the way.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, one of the things that I've noticed that the separatist side did that I think in retrospect, possibly, and even at the time, could be considered a bit of a mistake on this, was they tried so hard to lower the cost that they made promises, two main things that they thought would appease voters who, you know, to,
yeah, but this,
so
this
they wouldn't
where...
be saying, no, but the two are important. One is that we could continue to use the dollar, which how they could ensure that is not clear. The other is really the most important thing, I think, which really a nation is, a country is defined by its armed forces, right? Canada has a very long and storied military tradition that includes French Canadians that have been involved in that for hundreds of years at this point. And it was always assumed that we would be under the defense umbrella of the Canadian, well, we would just be part of that. And it's sort of based on this idea of the European Union. And I think that in my view, that was a kind of a mistake because if
Yeah,
you want
this
to
is.
tap into really the, one of the, you know, if you're not talking about economics, the spiritual nature of why a country exists, which is really why many French Canadians support it too.
Yeah, but
It's
this is
also
what.
that you want to be able to defend your borders,
Yeah,
right?
but this is where I would say that this is what you're arguing for is the how to convince. I'm not stating that there is a particular way you should convince. Like, I'm not stating to. What is the good way to convince that the costs are going to be minimal? But you cannot make that exercise without convincing Canadians, Quebecers, that the costs of the transition are going to be minimal relative to the alternative. And that's why you should expect, at least, especially if the referendum fails, that you should see no effect on output because people have priced in the promises that have been made. If they're not credible, they will have been priced in. If they're credible, they will also have been priced in. So people will behave in a particular way. And it will be priced in if their promises are not credible by the fact that they'll lose the election. And if they win, it's been priced in by the fact that they win the election. On GDP, there will be no effect either way. So
That's fascinating.
the
That's
only
really
way there could
fascinating.
be a
There's no
cost is
effect,
if
yeah.
afterwards people were like, if they're deceived into. So the separate, let's say, like we'll oversimplify. The separatists promise one thing and then they do the opposite thing, and people voted on the premise of the promise being held, and then they don't do it. Then yeah, that could be costly in the instance of a fail of a past secession, but in that case, the cost is not the secession per se, but the reneged promise, right? So it's not the same causal effect you're capturing. It's the effect of you didn't convince you convinced them on a basis and then lied and then reneged that argument for separation. And people had priced it in knowing that it wouldn't be costly. That's the point I make. And I again, as I said, I have separatist sympathies.
Yeah, I
And I
understand.
think that the answer, and I tell this to every separatist, is the best thing you can do to tell people that this will not be a crazy adventure is you. Just say, and it's going to sound weird from a separatist to say this, just say you're going to keep the monarchy.
Yeah,
Just say that the we're
Quebec
going to
becomes a parliamentary democracy of the Commonwealth.
we're keeping the exact same sets of institution that we have labored under since 1791. We have had British parliamentary institutions since 1791 in Quebec. We will stay under British parliamentary institution. We will not be a republic. We will remain a member, and we can vote on this 20 years from now. For now, we remain a, or something like this. We keep the exact same set of institutions. The only thing we are going to vote upon is whether or not we want to keep these historical traditions that we have inside the greater polity that is Canada or outside of it. The minute they say something like that, people will be like, holy shit, they're not promising crazy revolution. They're saying we're deciding in or within or without the rest of Canada.
One thing I can say about this is your generation, I assume you're born in the 80s,
Yes.
is that your generation was really the last one among Francophones as a generality in the population that was interested in this. Because
Yes, I agree
I
with
can
that.
tell you among the young, I'm around young French Canadians and those who are descended of other backgrounds. Among all of them, except for I would say 5 or 10% of my Francophone de souche students are really into it, and the rest of them are just, they don't care. They're not interested. It's Pépère, you know, talks about les Anglais or something, and they don't know. And right, you know what I mean? Like it's they're not. And I don't know why that has happened, but that has happened in this century, as a matter of.
I would say it's because if you people don't realize, but if you poll the young in Quebec, they're more conservative than people realize.
That's true. Yeah.
They're far more conservative in many ways. And I expect that one reason that a lot of them are not turned on by the idea of separation, independent of what I just said, is when you promise to make Quebec to be a country that's going to be left-leaning, blah, 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 blah. With, like, it just doesn't, it doesn't excite
doesn't resonate.
Them.
Yeah, it doesn't
and,
resonate.
Yeah. But the reality is, the only way to win a referendum is to credibly tie your hands.
Yeah.
That's the only way separatists can win. And it's not about like committing to being free market or being socialist or anything. It's to say what you will not do.
Yeah.
And this has nothing to do with being ideological. Is you want to commit to the rules of the game before. Yeah. I mean, when we play a game, it is totally reasonable that we agree on the rules before we play the game.
Yeah.
And the rules don't say how the game is going to turn out. It doesn't say which team is going to win. It says what the other team can't do.
Yeah.
You can't punch me at baseball. You can't you can't touch the umpire. The umpire is off limit. Third base means third base.
Well, you can't you can't play hockey and baseball at the same time, right?
Yeah,
you,
I mean,
you can't go out on ice skates with a baseball bat and you know that's kind of what you're saying, right?
So this is why separatists will continually lose until they forcibly say, "This is what we will not do. This is the list." And not only that, we're going to tie our hands because we're going to keep the same constitutional apparatus that we have had from before. We're going to keep our British traditional institutions. And it drives them nuts. But the reality is this is so.
It's perhaps the only way.
I want to say one last thing on this. And this is really important. This is from so I remember I'm an economist who does history. The thing I point out to people is that there's something really unique about Quebec. Is you have a bunch of French people who are probably the most British people in the history of mankind.
Yeah, that's very true.
French Canadians are insanely British. They are more British than the Brits in the very, and I've lived in the UK.
Yeah.
The French Canadians are British people. They are culturally inside a long tradition of British institutions. British institutions carry to the frontier world that is North America, where land is abundant and people are few.
Yeah.
It has the features. It is the most / British / American. There is no more Anglo-American people than the French Canadians. it is a weird oddity.
And part of it
promising to break from that
tradition.
Culture more than two centuries at this point. Two and a
it's
half.
It's not right something now. Francophones want, I think.
It's not something they're gonna jump on board.
Yeah.
Because it's just not it's you're asking them to jettison what is essentially a really long and complex history.
It's a part of our culture.
And this is why I say committing yourself to what you will not do, and this is the part in me that's more conservative than it is libertarian, is the world is improved by small tinkering on the margin. Radical reconstructions sometimes work, but rarely
sometimes
do.
Don't.
No, but sometimes do, but more often than not, end up with major ramifications in the long run.
Well, for every American revolution that's a success, you've got Russian Revolution, French. I don't know if the French Revolution is hard to gauge. The Haitian Revolution. You've got multiple revolutions that ended. You know, you could argue very badly. Yeah. But
tinkering at the margin is a much more
slow and steady progress. The Burkean idea.
Yeah,
right?
I'm very much a Burkean in this sense. Yeah. It is the slow, methodical tinkering. And is much more effective than what people, much less glorious, much less impressive. Nobody knows the name of the different prime ministers who did all those tinkering in the UK. And that's okay. And that's quite okay, because in the end, it ends up being a good thing that we do this tinkering.
Yeah.
And the idea for separatists, going back to this, is saying the only thing we're deciding is whether in the future we will decide as being part of Canada. Or being outside of Canada. We're not changing any other institutions than who we're deciding with.
Yeah,
It is a very modest reform. Like, it is a very modest reform if you think about how I phrase
well,
it.
yeah, it's actually it's not as modest as you think, I think. But the one thing I would say is from watching all of this over my life, I've developed a bit of a small theory. Just it'll take 30 seconds to explain it, that if you look historically, there's basically only two ways that nations that have really sustained over time, whether you're talking about Belgium or the United States or Haiti or Canada, that have become independent nations. It's not referendum. It's always one of two ways. It's the violent revolution, the American or the Russian or the Cuban method, or it's you were a colony and the home country ceded you independence without asking the population. And then that has sustained for decades or possibly hundreds of years. I've scoured, looked on the internet to try and find a case of a country where people, the population voted and it was successful and then it went on, and I can't really find one.
There is
Can you
one,
name it?
Sweden and Norway.
Okay, Sweden and Norway. Okay, so that's in
1905
my view,
is
that's
one
the
example.
exception that proves the rule. From Belgium, from Haiti,
But
from the United
there's another one
States,
that
from
came up recently. It's Serbia and Montenegro.
Okay, fair enough. There are. I'm not saying it was absolute. I'm just saying
No,
that
it's
in
just it
almost
is much
all cases,
harder.
yeah,
It is much harder in democratic setting
it's
to
much
achieve.
harder. And it also, one of the things that you see in places like you mentioned Scotland and in Canada is that it creates this acrimony in the population where, because let's say you can convince over 50% or even 60% of the population to be in favor, you've still got 40% of your people who really didn't want to do it, like really didn't want to,
Yeah, but
And
I would
that,
point
and
out.
if you have a war and people have to choose a side, then okay, then the people either who don't like it are going to leave, just like the loyalists left the United States.
Yeah, but
Those people like me, I will get on board and say, oh, all right, fine, I'm a Quebecois and I'll get on your side or whatever, Okay. And
okay,
it
so
forces people to choose a side, right?
I'll do something thought-provoking, and again, I think you'll see what I okay. Let me run with this with you.
Okay.
The only reason Canada is still a nation that's united is because there are separatists inside
That's an interesting theory.
it. The reason why is so I'm not only an economist who does history, I'm a public choice theorist. So I study the emergence of institutions and how they withstand from the vantage point of constraints on government that keep them from, because this is important that constitutions are constraints, but they're just pieces of paper.
Right.
Pieces of paper mean nothing unless
Unless
there's
they're
some,
observed, right?
unless no,
Yeah.
unless there's some form of enforcement mechanism.
Enforcement, that's what I mean. Yeah.
And
Yeah. No.
the thing that makes the Canadian Constitution work in some ways, the fact that there's a group of people that promise to leave. Every time the federal government wants to oversteps its boundaries, the separatists promise to leave, and so it keeps the federal government in check.
That's
So
interesting.
weirdly
Yeah.
enough, the reason Canada works for some reason is that there's this disgruntled minority that loses every time. And yet, weirdly enough, and this probably pisses them off to no end, is that they're actually what makes Canada stick together is as long as they're a credible threat to the continuation of the union, what you have is a check on federal power.
But not only that, the presence of one in four people in Canada, or one in five, one in four, whatever it is, who are Francophone, defines Canada. Like, Canada would not be Canada without that. It just, I can't imagine what Canada
Yeah,
would
but
be. It'd
that's
be something else. It might be an interesting country of some kind, but it would not be the Canada that I understand
yeah,
simply
I won't lie. I
socially,
don't find the
right?
rest of Canada that interesting. The only place
Yeah,
in
neither do
Canada
I. But I'm just saying that all of the ways that people think about Canada, at some point in the top 10 things that you would name as Canadian, it would come up with the duality there would enter in,
yes,
right? It would just it's a part of our national character,
but
right?
the duality runs deeper, is my point. The
Yeah, I get
duality
it.
is what, weirdly enough, creates a de facto system of checks and balances. Because otherwise, it's like saying
Compromise, right? I mean, it's a right.
more than just compromise. I really want to say check and balances because, like, if you check the first 20 years of Canadian Confederation, the federal government really tries to
Yeah.
trespass well above and beyond its original power. It consistently tries to do so. And it is only when Quebec tries to push back. The other provinces do, but
Sometimes they do. Alberta and Newfoundland, particularly Alberta, I think,
Yeah,
in
Alberta
recent
right now is
years.
really good at doing this, but each time, but Quebec had long an ability to push back in a particularly
Quebec
unique
is
way.
bigger, more
It's
powerful, has more people,
bigger,
right?
but also could also more convincingly promise to leave.
That's right. That's
Because
right.
the French minority wouldn't have a problem saying, yeah, no, we're on our own now. Like they have a less harder time to say this. So each time the federal government want to trespass over its power, I guarantee you that, like, especially if you're like a free market person, like who thinks small government is a good thing, if the separatist movement had for some reason not existed in 1960, Canada's central government would be massively larger than
Yeah,
otherwise would
that's
be the case.
interesting.
So I that thing is like people think that fractionalization inside a society is bad. It can be, but it can also be highly positive if it complements existing constitutional mechanism by acting as a safeguard for.
It forces people to be on their toes, is what you're saying. It forces, you can't just let things slide if you've got a threat all the time. You have to be careful, right?
Yes.
You have to kind of maintain things.
Yeah, this is why also I always say this. Laws are just pieces of paper. They have no power. Like constitutions have no power unless they reflect, they have embedded inside them some form of, because they're just de jure. So they're just legal papers.
They
And
have to be enforced.
there's always the old line from Pompey Magnus in ancient Rome. Why do you quote laws to us who have swords? It has been like this quote that has stuck with me for years.
It's a great quote.
It conveys everything we need to know. The only thing that prevents, that makes laws work or constitutions work, is that there is some form of de facto enforcement mechanism that is outside the law but complements it.
Or the
And
guys with swords are on the sides of the law. That's right.
yeah,
The other way, right?
or
Yeah,
that
that's
there's one
the
group of people with swords that can attack the other group with swords. And so the
right.
piece of paper says something about swords, but then the other parties actually create like a self-enforcement mechanism.
Exactly.
Constitutions work because they have this. Canada's constitution is working probably because there's a group who can potentially separate from the rest of Canada. It is the great Canadian paradox.
Okay. Listen, Vince, I know we got to close it out. So here's what I'm going to do for the last minute or two. I have a number of other things that I want to list here that maybe we could get to in a future podcast. One is your work on supply management.
Oh, God.
Which I saw you blow your lid once in French. It was the most hilarious thing. You were on TV in French. And you were talking about
Yeah.
that, and I remember you literally pété ta coche, you just
I'm really, I have a temper.
it was great. So that's something I'd like to get into. The other is just like the next time, if you would agree in the future at some point to talk again, we've basically brought Canada, I suppose, up to the 21st century in this discussion about the separatist movement. And I'd like to, if possible, in the future, to talk about some of the current challenges in Canada, Quebec and Canada, to do with slowing down of, the United States appears to be advancing more rapidly than we are at this point. This is something you may know something about. Would that be interesting for you to
I'd
talk
be
about those
happy to.
things? Okay, listen, it's just been such a pleasure, man. I mean, I miss you, man. And every time I see you when you're here, it's always fun. We haven't seen each other that much, but it's always interesting. And
We'll make sure Mike organizes something.
okay, yeah, he and I do a thing sometimes. I know you've tried to come to those where we get together, a bunch of us. We have our little group that we pretend to be the masters of the universe and
Yes,
this
yes.
kind of thing. And
Apparently
you fit right in.
libertarians have so much influence, apparently.
What's that?
Apparently, people who are libertarians have insane
Oh
influence.
yeah, we're dominating. We're killing it, and in Washington and everything. I mean, look at Mike Munger. He's practically president, right?
Well, I mean, in his criticism, because I like Mike, but I so thus I have to criticize him because I like him. He did run for governor, which is the.
He also didn't he for the Libertarian Party, right?
Yes, sometime in the 2000s, he did run for governor of North Carolina. And for that, that is the greatest stain on his record, in my opinion.
Okay, Vincent. Listen, so let's try and make that happen in a couple of months. This course, I'm building material for this course, and this is really, really helpful. So I want to just say thank you again, and I really
It was a
enjoyed it.
pleasure.
All right, man. Take
Cheers.
it easy.